Not too hot, not too cold. It is just about perfect here in the Rockies, as long as you don't mind dodging the occasional golf ball-sized hail in the afternoons. Welcome to Go West Young Podcast, your show about the outdoors and America's public lands. I'm Aaron Weiss at the Center for Western Priorities in Denver. Coming up today, the bird is the word. We've got everything you wanted to know about the sage grouse, why it's such a big deal, and what the heck just happened to that huge multi-state deal that was supposed to keep the grouse off the endangered species list. Plus, we will remember the Great Migration of 1843 on the Oregon Trail this week in Western history. You'd better believe that after last week, we do have some more John Wayne to listen to. But first, let's do the news. Public lands are shaping up to be an election year issue across the West. In Idaho, the Republican primary for governor was a showdown between one of the most vocal anti-public lands members of Congress, Raul Labrador, and the lieutenant governor, Brad Little. He's a moderate who has been supportive of national public lands. Well, Brad Little won that primary, meaning the general election will feature two public lands supporters. Raul Labrador's attacks on public lands simply didn't go over well, even among Republican voters. And on the other side, Paulette Jordan won the Democratic primary. Her platform puts protecting public lands front and center. And in Nevada, Senator Dean Heller just made public lands an issue in his race. He took a swing at his opponent, Jackie Rosen, for opposing a rider to the must-pass defense spending bill that would have limited the ability of the Fish and Wildlife Service to list the sage grouse as an endangered species. Democrats on the House Armed Services Committee argue that a listing decision on the sage grouse should come down to the science, not a political intervention by Congress. We'll have more on that from our guests in just a minute, but first, a couple of observations here. It's kind of remarkable that we are even seeing a single species of bird turn into a campaign issue in a U.S. Senate race. That is another sign of the large role public lands are going to play this election year. Secondly, and perhaps more importantly, the only reason this rider is even an issue right now is because the Trump administration has decided to undo that multi-state agreement that was designed from the beginning to keep the sage grouse off the endangered species list. That is why I called up Neda Culver. She's the senior counsel and director of the Wilderness Society's BLM Action Center. Neda knows all of the history here, as well as the legal landscape around the bird. I asked her first to take a step back and explain what the sage grouse is and why it's such a big deal.
Well, a sage grouse is a species of bird. And the reason it's a big deal are a number of things. One is it's a really cool bird, does some great mating dances. But the other reason it's such a big deal is it has historically inhabited hundreds of millions of acres across the West and still does inhabit quite a bit. And it also shares its habitat with hundreds of other species, ranging from other songbirds to interesting plants to, you know, what we would think about when we sing Home, Home on the Range, the mule deer, the pronghorn antelope, the elk, everything that we think of frolicking shares habitat with this bird. And so as the sage grouse goes, as the sage grouse habitat goes, so go ultimately hundreds of other species. So when we started to see sage grouse populations being impacted by various stressors on the habitat or things that destroy the habitat, that has an effect on the grouse, but also on so many other species that are kind of right there with it. So it was a really important kind of message for land managers around the West.
And how threatened is the bird right now? And walk us through the process that got us where we are today with this agreement toward the end of the Obama administration.
Yeah, sure. So where we were, not very long ago, was the Fish and Wildlife Service had looked at the condition of the habitat, the numbers present of the species, and reached the conclusion based on hard and fast science that this bird deserved, or warranted is the technical term, deserved to be listed under the Endangered Species Act as either threatened or endangered. So found that all the criteria had been met. So that's the direction we were heading, was some form of listing. And what happened at that point was we had had Western states and federal land managers during the Obama administration come together and say, well, what else can we do here? What can we do that could not only address this potential legal nicety of listing, but address what that really means? What it really means is the habitats at risk, the species at risk. And as we just talked about, that means a lot of other species are at risk. So we embarked upon not the shortest, but maybe not the longest process to come up with plans to manage the federal lands that the bird inhabits, because the federal government can make consistent rules across that habitat and controls about half of it. So we embarked on a, depending on how you measure it, 5 to 7 year journey to come up with plans to manage the 67 million acres of habitat on federal lands. But the kind of amazing part of that was the affected states across the West, the 10 states that participated. There's no, 11th that wasn't at the table, but 10 states across the West participated and helped to shape those plans, and also kind of committed to also take steps to manage the species on their lands as well. So we kind of came up with this large, you can call it an agreement, because everyone had to come to the table, of how we would manage all these lands. And because it was public land, the public got a say. And because it was an administration that really wanted buy-in from the stakeholders of the public lands, there was an extensive process to get the public, industry, ranchers, and obviously the states, sportsmen, everyone who might use those lands, which is pretty much every industry and every private entity, to the table. So that's what led up to the agreement.
It sounded like there was strong interest from everyone involved in avoiding a listing for the sage grouse under the Endangered Species Act. Why was that such a concern, or why is that a red flag for both the species and all the stakeholders here?
Yeah, I think it's both that once that finding is made, the listing is made, it kind of tells us we've failed to protect the species and the habitat, that we didn't take every step we could have or should have. So there's kind of that overall bad result. The other issue, of course, is once a species is listed, that gives the federal government some opportunity to manage the species not only on federal land, but private and state land. So that's a big incentive for states to come to the table and try to keep as much control as possible. Where the Endangered Species Act isn't in play, the states generally have control of the species, and the federal government might have control of the land. Once we have a listing, it's basically saying code red. We got to do everything we can to protect this species, and we're going to look at it across all land. And before you take an action that could harm it, you're going to have to consult. You're going to have to talk to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service before you take actions that could interfere with or harm the species or its habitat. So that imposes a whole new rule set that was not in place before.
So that gets us to January 21st, 2017. What has happened since then under the Trump administration?
And actually, what's happened, and I will say it was a surprise, because what we had in place was a plan across the federal acreage, a decision by the Fish and Wildlife Service that, based on the commitments made by the states and the federal government, that the sage grouse no longer warranted listing. And that was kind of impressive, because, we had not had time to show necessarily results on the ground, but we had these kind of ironclad commitments. And the Fish and Wildlife Service said, great, if everyone keeps their part of this bargain, we agree that the bird no longer warrants listing. And we believe the habitat will improve and things will be okay. And what happened in when this administration took over, they said, well, we don't like the deal anymore. And I think that was greeted with a lot of confusion, honestly, amongst all of us who had worked so hard. But they set out on a path to revise these plans that had only been in effect for a little over a year, to explicitly try to find ways to permit more energy development, fossil fuel development in particular, on these lands. And so that's where we started to embark upon a process to basically pull apart this kind of grand bargain or grand vision for the lands. And we are deep in the process now.
So it's worth pointing out, this was a bipartisan deal. You had a bunch of Republican governors, you had a Democratic administration. This was not the Obama administration imposing its will on a bunch of Republican governors to begin with, right?
No, in fact, when the record of decision for the plans was signed, Secretary Jewell, it was in Colorado, but Secretary Jewell was joined on stage at the ceremony, as it were, by the governor of Colorado, a Democrat, but also the governors of Nevada and Wyoming, who were Republican, but very much a bipartisan effort.
Given the amount of time that it took to reach this original bipartisan deal, 5 to 7 years, as you said, is there any way that Secretary Zinke's folks could have done their due diligence on the proper way to change this in just 1 year since taking office?
Not that I can come up with. You know, this did, as you said, it required a lot of input from different agencies. A lot of science was read and considered and synthesized. A lot of comments were considered. So far, what we've seen is, you know, an internal report was developed that explicitly looked at how do we create more development on these lands. So it had a different outcome in mind, and one that did not involve the sagebrush. So that's, to me, a problem right there. How could you do your due diligence to make sure you continue to conserve the greater sage grouse if you've explicitly abandoned that purpose? And then similarly, you know, we started down a road of planning and revisions, but again, instead of what we saw during the last administration, where there were numerous opportunities for the public to come to the table, for the Western governors to be engaged, et cetera. We didn't see that. So again, they're not getting the same input. We saw numerous letters, for example, from the Western Governors Association, which, as you mentioned before, is bipartisan, saying to the secretary, please consult us, please engage us. So we know from those letters that there wasn't, you know, as much cooperation as there should have been there. And those are a lot of the entities that have detailed information that you'd want to consider. And then there's the public, who technically owns the public lands. We had a very limited amount of opportunity for input so far. And yet we have these draft plans that have been issued in very short time and with one proposed approach. So we don't even have options to choose from. So it does not appear from what we've seen so far that they're doing their due diligence to see how these kind of actions could possibly continue to provide enough protections to conserve the sage grouse, to conserve the habitat, to protect all the other species that depend on it.
So let's get in the weeds legally then a little bit, since you're an attorney. Obviously, you know the ins and outs of this better than probably just about anyone else in the country. Is the approach that Interior has taken to these changes then, is that going to create issues down the road in court if they haven't done everything they need to do in terms of dotting their I's, crossing their T's, and getting the best science on the record?
You know, I think that that is a big risk. You know, the way that our public lands are managed is for the public, not surprisingly, as you might guess from their title. And the obligation that the Department of Interior has is to manage all of these uses on the federal lands. And in particular, when trying to keep species from being listed, they have obligations there. What there isn't is a legal right to just do what your friends want or to just support the oil and gas industry or the coal industry. Those are really not legal bases for changing plans or making management structures. And similarly, again, because these are public lands, there are requirements to involve the public, to do environmental analysis, to use, as you said, the best available science. So there are, those are all things that don't necessarily seem to be present in this process. So again, you know, we've seen this across the administration. There's a lot of directives and guidance on there that say, for instance, all of our decisions will be focused on supporting the fossil fuel industry. Again, not to me, their legal authority. That's outside to me what their legal obligations are. And we've also seen a lot of guidance that says we don't need to do environmental analysis and we don't need to involve the public, which are their legal obligations. So there's kind of a theme here, and we're seeing it with the sage grouse plans as well.
I assume the oil and gas industry was at the table the first time around and part of these discussions, and coal as well. You don't get Matt Mead on board with one of these decisions if you've got industry screaming in his ear that this is terrible. So what changed?
You know, it's an interesting point. If you look at the way these plans were looked at, especially in the Rocky Mountain region where we are, you know, one of the biggest threats identified by the Fish and Wildlife Service to the greater sage-grouse and its habitat was energy development and infrastructure. So you would have expected we would have seen in these plans closing lands to oil and gas leasing, to transmission, and that's not what happened. The administration basically said to these industries, we will give you a chance to show you can continue to develop these lands and not harm this habitat. Of the 67 million acres on the table, there were a couple hundred thousand acres taken that were actually closed to oil and gas leasing on only in Colorado. So, you know, there were a lot of efforts made to accommodate ongoing development from the industry. I think what happened is, you know, this administration came in with a rhetoric of we are going to do more oil and gas development and more coal development on public land. So if that's where you start, you look for every opportunity to increase that. And so I think what we saw was this administration saying, oh, well, there are certainly some restrictions on development in these plans. Let's get rid of all of the restrictions. Let's, you know, remove those protections. Let's see what else we can do to these plans because they do affect so many acres. So I think, you know, there was rhetoric from, we didn't really see it from individual companies so much, but, you know, certainly the oil and gas industry associations who consider it their job to, no matter what restriction or protection is in place, it's too much. So there has always been this kind of background, you know, rhetoric from the industry of any protection for a species, any limitation on development is too much. So, you know, you have those two rhetorics meeting, and it's a beautiful kind of union to look at every single decision that has been made and look for ways to change them. And I think that's what happened here. It got caught up in the rhetoric when the reality was very different.
I want to ask you to put on your bookie hat for a moment, if you could. If you're placing odds on the chances that the sage grouse now ends up on the endangered species list as a result of the uncertainty and what I assume is going to be years of court battles over what had been an agreement that wasn't going to land in court, what has all of this done to the chances that the sage grouse ends up on the endangered species list after all?
Well, since even when I'm wearing my bookie hat, I'm a lawyer, I can't actually give you numbers. But I can tell you a couple things. You know, what the Fish and Wildlife Service based its finding on was that here was a consistent, reliable, scientifically based set of management across 67 million acres of habitat, and that those commitments were clear. They were going to be met. There was everybody kind of had agreed, and they could rely on it to say, even though the habitat hasn't magically improved yet when we sign these agreements, everybody has promised to keep their part of this bargain. Therefore, we can tell you it no longer needs to be listed. What we're seeing now is a process that's, we don't actually want to do that anymore. We're going to take that part away. We've already seen, for instance, some of the commitments that were made in the plans, for example, to drive leasing and drilling outside habitat. This administration has said we're not going to abide by them. So once you start to, you know, weaken the entire structure of these plans and back off on your commitments, it's going to be harder and harder for the Fish and Wildlife Service to still find that there are sufficient protections because you've both removed actual protections and undermined your commitment to them. So that starts to increase the chances in terms of, you know, scientifically based, if we just look at the language and policy that's here. And we also see it on the ground, it's going to start harming this habitat, affecting not just the greater sage grouse, but all these hundreds of other species. The one twist we have here is right now Congress has enacted a limitation preventing the Fish and Wildlife Service from formally listing the greater sage grouse under the Endangered Species Act. So there's a political aspect of this that also would ultimately need to be addressed. And I think it will, because it's just not, doesn't make a lot of sense to tie the hands of the Fish and Wildlife Service, to ignore science, to ignore the reality of what is happening. So in terms of whether it could get listed in the next few months, both the science and the political aspects of this would say no. But in the coming months and years, I think that's the direction we're heading if we don't stop and go back to the parameters of the agreement that everybody committed to abide by in the first place.
All right. Neda Culver is Senior Counsel and Director of the Wilderness Society's BLM Action Center. Neda, thank you so much for taking the time and for sharing your insight today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
So what does all of this mean for the folks on the ground who are dealing with the sage-grouse plans day in and day out? Let's bring in Mary Flanderka with the Wyoming Outdoor Council. And before that, she was with Wyoming Game and Fish Department implementing the state's sage-grouse strategy. So Mary, was that must have been a years-long process for you?
Oh, it started back in 2008 and even before that. Wyoming worked in establishing local sage-grouse working groups that tried to identify threats and opportunities. Governor Freudenthal was involved in a huge conference and workshop that began the sage-grouse executive order. Then Governor Mead followed behind him and continued to support it. There were iterations and iterations of the SGO as we learned new things and we learned what would work and what wouldn't work. So this has been going on for well over 10 years.
And so after that decade-long process, we had the success with the plan to avoid an ESA listing, and then the Trump administration comes in. What did you think when you heard that Secretary Zinke was looking at undoing or changing the deal that was in place that you'd worked on for a decade?
Well, it was very frustrating, you know, because ESA is the Endangered Species Act has always been fairly political and people swing back and forth. But in Wyoming, I mean, we gathered not only 21 appointed interests, but the public was always invited to come up with this plan. Now, under the Obama era, Wyoming was a little bit concerned that they had overprescribed in the amended resource management or approved resource management plan amendment. It's called the ARMPA now. And that was frustrating. But then when Zinke came in, it was equally frustrating because he underprescribed or proposed to underprescribe. And I hate to say this, but I'll use the analogy of Goldilocks. I think Wyoming had worked to get it just right in the balance between conservation and economic development inside the state.
So at the end of the day, you're saying that this came down to striking the right deal that ensured enough development that the oil and gas industry wasn't going to obviously completely die, but at the same time protecting the grouse. In Wyoming, then, specifically, since you're so familiar with these plans, what are your concerns about the changes that the secretary is trying to move forward with, and what does that actually mean on the ground for ranchers and for the bird and for oil and gas operators?
Well, I can give you my early estimates of what I think is happening. Governor Mead has been a very strong supporter of the sage-grouse executive order and the BLM plan as well. As you know, in Wyoming, it's an all-lands plan. It's not just BLM. It's BLM, private, and state lands, which is a great option for the bird. As we're reviewing the draft EIS right now, what we're finding is that they've adhered fairly strict to what Governor Mead has requested for change. But we find that they wander off the page a little bit. And there's some language in there that may include too much flexibility. There's some weird language inside the EIS that has to be dealt with to make sure that there's a commitment by the BLM to actually enforce the plan.
One of the things that I heard early on, and it stuck with me probably because it rhymes, as far as ranchers go, is this notion that what's good for the herd is good for the bird. Can you explain why that is and what that process was working with ranchers on this whole process?
Sure. And it's not just the herd as in ranchers, it's as in the herd as in sportsmen and big game as well. So when you have healthy sagebrush ecosystems, there's grasses, forbs, a lack of weeds, you know, good, healthy plants out there, which is good for both livestock and for big game animals as well, and also non-game species.
I asked Neda to put on her bookie hat and place some odds on the chances after all this that the sage grouse ends up on the Endangered Species Act as a result of all these shenanigans that Secretary Zinke is trying to pull. What's your take on that, on a potential listing now, or what are the other scenarios for how this plays out?
So I'm not a great bookie, but I know that Wyoming is doing its part to make sure that the bird is not listed. You know, a significant portion of the birds are in Wyoming, and all the partners, industry, conservation, local governments are all doing their part to make sure that we have a good plan and the bird is not listed. I don't even want to speculate what's happening in other states. I hope they're doing it, though.
All right, Mary Flanderka with the Wyoming Outdoor Council, thank you so much for taking the time. And I know you've got to hit the road, so thank you so much for your insight today.
Well, thank you, Aaron. I appreciate it very much.
Let's wrap up with a look back at this week in Western history. This week marks the Turquoisquicentennial, that is to say, the 175th anniversary of the Great Migration of 1843. I just want to say Turquoisquicentennial a few more times. It was the first large wagon train to set off on the Oregon Trail. On May 22nd, 1843, around 1,000 pioneers left Elm Grove, Missouri. At the time, there were just over 400 white settlers in the entire Oregon Territory, so this single wagon train would more than triple the population if they got there. They were largely farmers, unhappy with their prospects in Ohio, Kentucky, Tennessee, and Illinois. They were inspired by propaganda from the government, from fur traders and missionaries, promising a better life out west. The train consisted of more than 100 wagons, with 5,000 head of cattle and oxen behind them. Many of them feared the threat of hostile Indians on the trail, but the real risks were much more pedestrian. Falling off a mule or a horse, rattlesnake bites, drowning while you cross a river, and most of all, disease. Sure, it's a punchline now, thanks to the video game, but dying from dysentery was a very real threat on the Oregon Trail. Also cholera, mountain fever, measles. Somewhere between 6 and 10% of all the emigrants in those days got sick and died on the trail. When the pioneers got to Fort Hall on the Snake River in what's now Idaho, agents from the Hudson's Bay Company told them to abandon their wagons and use pack animals the rest of the way. But a missionary named Marcus Whitman, who had been in Oregon for nearly a decade, volunteered to lead the wagons onward, making whatever trail improvements they needed as they went. The pioneers cut a trail through heavy timber in the Blue Mountains of eastern Oregon. Then they stopped at the Dalles, because there was no road around Mount Hood. They disassembled the wagons and floated them down the Columbia River. The livestock was herded over Lolo Pass. By October, 5 months after they set out, nearly all the settlers had made it to the Willamette Valley. Those first settlers drafted the Organic Laws of Oregon, giving married couples up to 640 acres of land for free. Unmarried settlers got half that. The group had no official authority under American or British law, but the U.S. government eventually honored their claims anyway. The next year, fewer settlers made the journey on the Oregon Trail, but nearly 3,000 went in 1845, and the journey became an annual event, with those giant wagon trains eventually giving way to smaller groups of a couple dozen wagons at a time. In 1846, the Barlow Road was completed around Mount Hood, creating a passable trail some 2,000 miles long, ending at Oregon City, just south of what's now Portland. In all, an estimated 350,000 people traveled the Oregon Trail. The numbers started to trail off, if you will, once the Transcontinental Railroad was completed in 1869. The railroad, of course, was cheaper and safer, but some families kept using the trail well into the 1890s. Of course, the Oregon Trail made it into the popular consciousness long before the video game came along. In Count with me here. The Oregon Trail was the subject of silent films in 1923 and 1928, two talkies starring a young John Wayne in 1930 and 1936.
Hey, you got back here at last, eh?
Yeah, there's plenty of buffalo sign out here, so I'll be riding out to pick up fresh meat.
Well, who's keeping you?
I'll see you at the river crossing.
That's from The Big Trail in 1930. The 1936 film appears to be lost, so check your attic. You might have some Hollywood history up there. The Trail was back in theaters again in 1939, 1945, two different movies in 1947, and 1959 is the last feature film I could find. That is 10 in all. The Oregon Trail video game first came around in 1971, if you can believe it. And there was an NBC TV series that ran for 14 episodes in 1976 and 77.
Kind of dusty, the earth beneath my feet. Kind of dusty, as I ride through the burning heat.
Today, large stretches of Interstate 80 and 84, along with US 26 in Oregon, parallel the original trail. You can find landmarks along the way, including registers where immigrants carved their names, even wagon ruts that have survived 175 years since the first major wagon train set off on the Oregon Trail, this week in Western history. Well, that's all I got this week. If you've just recently discovered the podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. That is the best way for new listeners to find us. You can also send your feedback and ideas for future episodes to podcast@westernpriorities.org. Thanks again to Mary Flanderka from Wyoming Outdoor Council, Nada Culver from the Wilderness Society for their insights into the sage-grouse. We will be back in a couple of weeks. My name is Aaron Weiss, and on behalf of all of us at the Center for Western Priorities, thanks for listening.
Miss Ruth, you shouldn't be riding out here alone like this, away from the train.
Why not?
Because this is dangerous country, and anything might happen.
You wouldn't care.
Care? Me?